The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. In this programme, those old romantics Glass Vegas tell us about the hypnotic effects of writing songs.
The beauty of rock and roll is in the ears of the beholder, really, and it's just as simple as kind of crossing your fingers and saying, like, you know, just trying your best.
Plus, we review tracks from Actress, Britney Spears and Thomas Dolby. That's all in Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, one and all. I am joined by Kitty Empire.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. And Ben Beaumont Thomas.
Hello.
How's tricks, Ben?
Excellent. Good. Tricks are good.
Tricks are good. What have you been up to? Anything exciting?
I met one of my heroes, actually, recently, who I was organising an event with. Matthew Herbert was on a panel.
Wow. How was
he?
He
was enjoyably ranty, which was exactly what I wanted out of a fruity pound debate discussion. So, yeah.
Kitty, have you met any of your heroes recently?
Not recently, sadly, although I have to say I did once interview Patti Smith, which... Pretty much.
How was that? Was she amazing?
She was amazing. All the cliches about people like that having charisma and an aura about them, I fear, are sadly true.
Yeah. No, I saw her a couple of years ago at the Royal Festival Hall as part of Ornette Coleman's Meltdown, and she just walked on stage, and there's just something about... You're either super cool or you're not.
People do things to the molecules in the air, and you can't really explain what it is, but she had it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. Well, Rosie Swash is recovering from a hectic time in Austin. She was for South by Southwest. Alas, I gather via Twitter that she suffered a profound case of runny bum while she was in Austin.
I'm sure she's sad that you shared that with her.
Well, she shared it with the world on Twitter, okay. So I mean, she didn't just secretly tell me. I think she had a bad burrito or something like that. We wish her well, obviously. And we move on. We start this week with Glass Vegas. Ben, you went to speak to Glass Vegas for us.
Yeah, it was a fascinating meeting. Incredibly charming people, actually. And they really did look like rock stars. They sort of totally swaggered in rather than walked. Yeah, three of them were dressed in black, and James, the lead singer, was resplendent in a white Llewellyn Scott coat, an entire white ensemble.
Wow.
Some Glaswegian John Lennon vibe.
I like bands that are never off duty. You know what I mean? Clothes-wise,
exactly.
I really think that's that. You see Nick Cave around in Brighton. I saw Nick Cave in B&Q on the Old Shore Road in Brighton buying some screws once, and he was dressed as Nick Cave at, like, whatever it was, 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and I thought, right on.
Off to make some really kind of baroque, sexy furniture.
Yeah, possibly. They've been away for a long time. Well, you know, a relatively long time, Glass Vegas. They've been recording a new album called Euphoric. How do they pronounce it? It's got all these slashes.
I think it's just Euphoric Heartbreak, but we should mention that it is /... Euphoric, /... Heartbreak. All in capital letters. Or is it the backslashes at the end?
Ah, oh, man, I don't know.
Do you see, at least with MIA, they spelt her name.
They did out of the things.
Exactly.
Yes, they did. And when you put it in iTunes, it came up like that, didn't it?
Very,
amazing.
Very well thought
out. It's one brilliant anecdote after another from me today, isn't it? Anyway, the lineup's changed. The drummer's gone, which is a bit sad.
Right. Well, I know there's a new drummer.
There's a new drummer there who's Swedish.
That's right, yeah.
They ended up touring with U2. They were nominated for a Mercury Prize for their debut. And he has had some sort of episode.
There was some kind of
drug
classic
overdose.
Drug-based rock star episode, that led to a sort of semi... epiphany. And I think I was reading in The Enemy this week that he said that his low point was when his fellow band member Paul, who's just, like, by all accounts a complete rampant party boy and hasn't got any teeth, basically said, "I think you've been overdoing it a bit, mate." They vaguely alluded to various hijinks, especially when I think they supported U2, and there was some kind of vague allusions. Then they all kind of went to the huddle and they were like, "No, we're not going to massively dob ourselves into for whatever they did." So, but they said they lost money supporting U2, and there was like tens of thousands of pounds worth of damage to something, but they wouldn't tell me
what it was.
Yeah, no, I really don't
Bono.
Know.
Bono. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. His sunglasses collection, irreparably damaged.
Anyway, look, because this is obviously Music Weekly rather than prurient interest in what drugs they're taking weekly, Ben started with their album and asked what the experience of the success of their debut album was like.
So, with the first record, were you surprised at how massive it got?
it kind of took off and suddenly everyone knew about you. Did you react to that in the way that you had thought you'd react to that?
It was living in some kind of, you know, fantasy. And then there's other part of it that I've always been quite unaware of my limits and stuff like that. So I've always been probably punching above my weight my full life, you know. So I still, at this point now, I think sometimes it's the strangest thing that's ever happened to me in my life, that people would sing a song like, say, for example, Daddy's Gone, and actually sing it like it's a celebration or something. I still think that is so strange. I was working on one of the B-sides and it was like 5 in the morning. Guys were walking past for a live and they were singing Daddy's Gone, like a bunch of them. And I just stopped playing guitar and I was like, And I just kept playing again. And then I stopped and I was like, hold on. It's not weird that they were singing it. It's weird that I didn't think that was unusual. And it wasn't that long ago. I was unemployed and that seemed like a distant kind of planet, you know.
Do you think it's weird having to put your songs out into the world like that and, like you say, have crowds of thousands of people perhaps misinterpret them? I mean, does that frustrate you? Or?
No, it's something I'm getting more used to now because I know the potential of what a pop song can do. And, well, to contradict that, you know, there was a little part of me that's probably quite scared a bit because I don't really want to hurt anybody's feelings, you know. And I said to Rab, you know, I don't really want to put Daddy's Gone or put it in the album and stuff. And he was like, shut your face. We're putting it in the album. It's a good song.
So something I find with bands who write from their own lives and sing songs about their experiences is that once they get success, they can obviously start to sing about those new experiences. They're on the road, they're wealth, their fame and the troubles or not that brings along with it. How do you kind of maintain that sort of connection with the man in the street once you are one step removed from ordinary life, as it were?
I think it's really hard to plan for any of those things you mentioned, and I don't think we're under any illusion that we're going to like do this or do that. A lot of the time it's such a timing and a luck thing. I think even in the writing, I still write songs now and I just think it's just lucky. Lucky not in the way that that I can say emphatically that I've written a good song. That's the beauty is be rock and roll, and so to speak, it's in the ears of the beholder, really. And it's just as simple as kind of crossing your fingers and saying, like, you know, just trying your best.
How was the sort of Santa Monica experience for all of you? I mean, did you feel like you were making similar songs in a new locale, or was it, wow, these are LA songs?
If there is such a thing as a rock and roll fantasy, then I guess that would be quite close to it. You know, some days you can be bloody petrified, man, you know, and other days you feel like bloody colossal. I think sometimes along the way, playing the gigs and being so involved in it, your perceptions and your intentions get a little bit warped along the way. And I thought I was more important than what I was. And you, through a few different experiences, you kind of realise that the world still revolves when you're no touring, you're no doing your thing, and maybe I wasn't as important as what I thought I was, you know. And then so basically you've got to kind of ask yourself a few questions, and you kind of, you need to take yourself back to the beginning of why you were doing it. And I think sometimes the less shallow reasons and more kind of sincere and authentic reasons why you were in a band in the first place. Sometimes when you do shatter yourself down, I think when you put the pieces back together, I think you're like normally a little bit tougher than what you were before. if there was any pressure of that, it was a pressure that we put on ourselves, because we're quite romantic people, and we like happy endings. We don't like when things don't fulfil their potential. And having a platform now, which we didn't have when we first started the band, and having some audience, we've got that now, and so there is those pressures too. You know, but then when the focus kicks in and you're deep in the cave or you're in the wormhole, you know, just like when you're a fighter, when you're running with football, dribbling, you can't hear the crowd, you can't hear anything else. And I'm glad that we were able to do that. We've already succeeded, you know, because we feel as though we've expressed ourselves with some kind of authenticity, and we feel as though we've fulfilled the potential that we had for this record.
There's a line I remember reading that a writer wrote about another band, Doves, when he was watching them live, and he said that they're music for big lads to hug each other to. I always remember that line when I listen to your music, that it's this quite big-hearted, emotional music, but almost that it's music that kind of drags emotion out of people and out of cold people, perhaps. Is that something you're trying to do, or...?
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I think it's pretty hard for people to just let go. And I always remember one night when I was in a nightclub with Rab before we were in the band, and I remember a Smith song came on, and it was this guy that looked really stereotypical, kind of tough guy. He was walking through the dance floor. He was singing something like, "Kindness is nice." Kindness will stop you from doing all the things in life you'd like to. And I was like, that's so bizarre. Well done, Morrissey. And I thought, Morrissey, you've made it. I don't know how you think you've made it and how he would gauge his success, but I was like, you've made it, man. And the guy could kind of, I guess, just lose himself in whatever the music was that was playing. I do understand what you mean, and I still get guys that, you know, older guys that will come up and say, son, you wrote that song, Daddy's Gone, and that relates to a lot of my life. But then there's kids, really, really young kids, that will just be the exact same.
From a layman's point of view, it seems impossible to write a song like that can resonate individually with so many people and yet be about quite a kind of big emotion. How do you kind of hone in on the emotions you want to transmit, I suppose, with your work?
First of all, be arm's length away from it. I think when it's too much there, it's over emotional and it's unfocused and stuff. Mm. Like, just, you know, not your heart not being in something, but also being too consumed by it and too over emotional. Mm. You know, when I was writing Daddy's Gone, I wasn't crying on a sheet of paper. I was as close to coming hypnotised as what I'll ever come. It's that little daydream, and then you kind of snap out. That's how I go mad if somebody walks in the room and I'm writing. Or if my sister walks in to ask me if I'm going to make her a cup of tea and a bit of toast, and I don't hear her there, and then she comes in from behind me, because it's almost like I'm coming out the little daydream, I'm coming out too fast.
Right, OK, Las Vegas, speaking to Ben there. It's an interesting state of affairs that Las Vegas find themselves in. Over the weekend, I was reading Neil Taylor's History of Rough Trade Records. It's a really great book, and there's one bit in it where Jeff Travis, somebody from Rough Trade, is talking about the fact they never had contracts with bands, or proper contracts as such with bands, and he said, oh, in a way that was deliberate, because bands tend to get worse rather than better, which I thought was an amazing thing to say from someone who runs a record company, and sort of proves that notion of... you know, the difficult second album, that kind of thing, is not necessarily a new one. You know, he's talking about bands in the 80s. Do you think Las Vegas, being a band that sort of emerged pretty fully formed with a sound and a look and all that kind of thing, will struggle with the second album?
I think that they have raised the bar for themselves to a quite high level. They mentioned that they felt that they had a much wider palette of sounds and potential that they have. Now they have a new drummer who's a lot more dexterous, and they're able to do more things with the sort of rhythms of their work. If you permit me to quote Stravinsky in the context of Las Vegas, there's a great quote from Stravinsky where he says, "The more restrictions I place on myself, the freer I become." And I thought that...
That's very Dogma, very Jack White.
I was going to say yes, Jack White. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that the brilliance and the beauty of that first album came from
their restricted rhythmic palette, I think. Mm. There's this kind of lumpenness to it that somehow manages to be really beautiful and really impactful and
I
and
think
affecting.
That's really true. I think it's a bit like the slightly odd, but I think nonetheless pertinent theory that Oasis started declining when they got rid of Tony McCarroll on drums, because there was something about having this guy that couldn't really play the drums.
Monolithic vibe.
Yeah, that was sort of just made it kind of better. Kitty, do you like the album? Have you heard Euphoric /Backslash, whatever the canal it is, Heartbreak?
It's a load of pants.
You really hate it?
I think it's overblown. I think it's overproduced. I think Flood should be, well, perhaps not shot, but...
It's a bit harsh on Flood.
I think their first album captured everything we've just said. It's very much... unique individual sounding. I loved it because it ticked some boxes for me. I'm an absolutely huge Jesus and Mary Chain fan.
I was going to say, you love Jesus and Mary Chain.
So I was straight in there. Mm. I find that bands moving from Glasgow to California invariably fall into loads of traps of making more ambitious music, making music that's drenched with sunshine and sort of Californian cliche. I feel they probably felt they needed to move up a gear, all those cliches about... Yeah. Having the bigger sound palette. Is it good music? It's probably not dreadful, but it's not as good as their first one, and it is very bombastic, and I don't like being told what to feel by producers.
It's not like I thought their debut album would. It wasn't sort of a record that sold itself on the incredible subtlety of feelings. That it was,
right,
you know what
yeah,
I mean? Yeah. I mean, it is. There was a brilliant line that Dorian Lynskey said about it, and it's like one of those things, like when somebody says to you, George Osborne's nose looks a bit like a penis. And once someone said that to you, you can't really look at George Osborne, you know, because all you see is this penis.
What have you done now?
Well, Dorian Lynskey said, the guy, I loved Las Vegas. And Dorian Lynskey said in a review, the guy from Las Vegas always sounds to me like a bloke drunkenly singing outside his ex-girlfriend's window at 3 o'clock in the morning until she throws a shoe at him. And at that point, I was just like, no, you sort of ruined it for me. You know, but
if I could just briefly interject, I think James is dressing like all four Manic Street Preachers at once. He's got the aviator shade, he's got the white T-shirt. I believe they may have looked at the Manics and thought we'd like some of that.
Yeah, Manics comparison's interesting, actually, because the Manics are a band who managed to go from being a kind of indie band to make that step to stadium connection.
Absolutely.
And I think that is one of the... We read of music critics who are often very snobby about Bono, about Chris Martin. Mm. But I think they really have a unique and very, very rare talent connecting... with on that stadium level and making each person feel like they're being sung to and also in a communal experience. That's very, very rare. That's definitely what Las Vegas are aiming to do. And I think that they have it in them to do that. I just think that, as Kitty said, I think the production on this album, it hampers
sort of overwhelms
that kind of... Yeah, it makes them sound like they're trying too hard.
I mean, that kind of music, you're talking about U2, Coldplay or whatever, it's not my cup of tea at all. It's not really something I particularly like. You are absolutely right that the ability to connect with a vast room of people is, or a vast stadium or a vast festival full of people is a really rare skill. And I always think, actually, the venue that sorts you out a little bit is Brixton Academy. And, you know, I remember seeing the Strokes at Brixton Academy at the height of their fame. And it just didn't communicate, it didn't connect, didn't. And a few weeks later, I saw REM play a Glastonbury warm-up there. And, I mean, again, REM are not a band I've ever particularly loved, you know? And it was like Brixton Academy was bulging with their sound, you know what I mean? It was like, it's like, you just know how to do this. I think as a frontman and as a kind of figurehead for the band, James from Las Vegas can do that. I think he has the potential within him to do that. Whether this is a slight misfire, this album, on the route to doing that, is a sort of moot point. We'll be intrigued to hear your thoughts on it, of course. Las Vegas' new album, Euphoric Heartbreak, is out on April the 4th. They tour next month too. And now we move on. Time to listen to a few tracks and singles, Club One each. We share our opinions on them afterwards. We're going to kick off with Kitty's Choice. Feel the earthquake, gonna make your body shake. Till the second start to break in the speaker. Can we get fly? Helicopter in the sky, cause we turn it up high in the speaker. If you know what it takes to be my man, we can go make love together. You can be my thug tonight. We can tear it up tonight. I wanna go down where my posse's at, because I got nine lives like a kitty cat. You wanna roll Britney Spears with How I Roll from her new album Femme Fatale. Kitty, that's your choice. Tell us why you brought that in.
I brought that in because it's the Britney song that hasn't left my brain since I heard the Britney album in full. I'm a sucker for anything that sounds like a playground taunt, and that's definitely got a kind of skipping rhythm to it, whilst being very digital. I think the production is mwah. And also has a tremendously rude word in it in the midst of all this quite childlike stuff, which I like the contrast. This new Britney album is, I think, one of the better ones for a while. I tend to like albums without ballads on them. There's barely a ballad on here.
Yeah, I think that's a very wise move. You're producing a Britney Spears album, not or executive producing a Britney Spears album. Don't put any ballads on it.
I do have some problems with the album as a whole, but this is definitely an absolute peach of a tune. It really doesn't leave your ears alone.
I think it's an interesting album, and I struggled with it a bit in review because part of me is so frustrated at the void at the centre of all Britney Spears records, where Britney Spears should be. Because, I mean, this is utterly characterless, you know, frankly, rotten vocalist whose style is not, I feel, helped by the slathering of autotune on her voice, which just makes me more emotionally disconnected. And then I thought, why is that bothering me? Why do I care? You know, if I wanted to listen to somebody that's being really impassioned, I'd go listen to Las Vegas. You know what I mean? That's not what I'm coming to Britney Spears for. I don't know. This is one of the tracks I liked more on the album. I thought there was some winners. I liked, like you, the combination of the weird electronic backing and the sort of nursery rhyme simplicity of the tune. Ben, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting you're saying about the void, because I think that she's a really interesting, fits into the kind of pop climate, if you were, in an interesting way, that she's very malleable and she is putty in the hands of the producers. Kitty said they do a lot of things with it, and she has this quite kind of kittenish, wide-eyed innocent vibe on this track, and then there's some of those ones where she has this really like slutty sort of Orange County The Hills sort of accent, which is completely different. She's actually very versatile, I think, and she always allows you to place yourself into her world, I think, in that sort of her malleability.
She is a blank canvas. Basically, around the time of the album, this essence of Britney kind of became concrete, which I have called in my review out this Sunday, a dead-eyed lubriciousness, which is basically, it's all sexy, sexy sex, come hither, rumpy, pumpy dance floor, woof, woof. You know, it's all very, very sexually charged, and it is yet dead-eyed. It is very blank. On Blackout, I found that a bit of a problem, considering she was having what we could probably assume is a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
I found the disconnect between her reality of having her children removed and her father minding her financial affairs, and yet she was down the clubs being a Duracell sex bot bunny. I found that very difficult. However, on this record, I find it sort of a bit easier. If you're going to have dead-eyed sexy pop singers, this one does it.
I think it's an interesting thing to see her coming back into a sort of pop world whose terms are now being dictated to a large extent by Lady Gaga, who's sort of the anti-Britney in a lot of ways, in that it's all about connection with the fans, it's all about appealing to the freaks and weirdos. I'm not saying that her records are any better. I think actually Lady Gaga as an artist is being wildly overrated. I really don't think her records are as good as people are making it out to be. The reason she's being overrated is because she's making an effort in an arena where most artists make no effort whatsoever. You know what I mean? She's clearly thought about things. In a world where, you know, I saw Lady Gaga live, I think, 3 times last year. And that was sort of foremost in my mind. Then I heard the sound, I was like, wow, this is the way things used to be. It's this kind of like...
It's like the stakes are lower, but I think that, you know, if you compare with someone like Jessie J, who's just so... That's really staring into the void of humanity, you know, to listen to Jessie J. I mean, that's really...
Oh, steady.
Oh, no, I mean, but she's so charmless and so desperate for love in a way that Britney doesn't seem to be, and it's just much more charming, and I just find her a lot more appealing than...
Without besmirching Britney's character, I think of all those mouseketeers that became pop stars, I think Justin Timberlake definitely got the brains as well as the looks. I think Christina Aguilera got some looks and some brains as well. And I think Britney perhaps is not entirely the mistress of her own destiny.
That's an intriguing discussion provoked by Britney Spears. How I Roll is a track from the album Femme Fatale, which is out, I believe, on Monday. Okay, next up, it's My Choice.
Soaring on a third
That's Thomas Dolby, Oceaneer, which is the title track from an EP out on the 28th of March, I believe. I brought that in. I am an unrepentant fan of Thomas Dolby. I realise that you could probably not pick a less fashionable person to like, in that his music has gone sort of unrevived even by LaRue. You know, and LaRue, on the base of that mix album LaRue did recently, she likes any old cobblers from the 80s.
Monge, for God's sake.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Ellis Beggs and Howard, who were the sort of prog-influenced offshoot of Kajagoogoo, had a track on there, Big Bubbles, No Troubles. He's a sort of weirdly forgotten and slightly overlooked figure, Thomas Dolby. It's easy to forget what a pivotal kind of guy he was at one point in the 80s. He was the go-to guy for like sort of 60s people who were trying to get a handle on the 80s and produced Joni Mitchell and things like that. Not, it has to be said, not terribly sympathetically and not terribly well. His skill, I think, is best expressed in his first two albums, The Golden Age of Wireless from 1982 and The Flat Earth from 1984, which I think are genuinely amazing forgotten records, and they symbolise a slightly forgotten thing in music, which I was, it's like 80s prog pop, and it's that sort of point where you get people who are ostensibly synth pop figures make these kind of strange albums with lots of Fairlight synthesizer on them out, lots of fretless bass, a bit too much fretless bass, with incredibly weird long songs on it. And I'm thinking of records like sort of Brilliant Trees by David Sylvian, The Dreaming by Kate Bush, to a certain extent Sulk by The Associates, that kind of
Blue
thing.
Nile.
Blue Nile, yeah, absolutely. Hats by The Blue Nile, or Walk Across the Rooftops by The Blue Nile. And particularly The Flat Earth fits into that. And it's a record I've loved since I was about 12 and will defend to the death. His subsequent work, which he went to America doing the most 80s thing he possibly could. He married the good woman that played Fallon off Dynasty. Went to America and started making kind of quite boring sort of funk records. Has subsequently made huge sums of money. He invented the technology that allows polyphonic ringtones to be used on mobile phones, made vast sums of money. Has come back to Britain with his family and now lives on a houseboat somewhere in the wilds of Norfolk, and seems to have started making music in the vein of The Flat Earth again. I was listening to a big pile of singles, new singles, I thought they were all rubbish. This came up in the middle of it. I thought, oh, God, I bet Thomas Dolby's new single isn't up to much. But I really liked it. I thought it was sort of floaty and weird and expressive of the landscape in which he was living and all that kind of thing. And I'll shut up now and let somebody else talk about it.
If you'll permit me, another pretentious quote from the Golden Age of Modernism. I think Fitzgerald said something when he complained about writers that only wanted to write novels and didn't need to write novels. And I think there's an audible comfort to the kind of music he's making. Like, he doesn't need to make this music. I think it's a bit of a vanity project, really.
Sure.
But that doesn't preclude the fact that it is a very beautiful track. Slightly, perhaps, cringeworthy signifiers towards eco-living, yeah, and sort of Gaia, almost. But I know I really liked it, and yeah, and I agree that Dolby's contribution to should put on a nerd voice for this, but his production for Prefab Sprout, Steve McQueen,
amazing,
is,
yeah,
is exemplary.
Absolutely great.
So I think he's done some brilliant work in the past. It's good to see him still making music. Yeah.
Kitty?
It's wafty. I don't like
wafty. You don't
wafty.
Like wafty?
I'd like to point out that the three EPs he's releasing are called Americana, spelt with a K, Oceania, and then there's going to be one called Urbanoia.
Yeah,
do you see what he did?
Yeah.
Sounds now, like a bad Nine Inch Nails project.
Now, yes. Now, I think, following on from what Ben said, I have great trouble with smug music that isn't necessary in a way that, let's go back to Glas Vegas, in the way that you think probably that first Glas Vegas album, it was all boiling along and James's soul and needed to come out. And this is all very nice. I hear your love for him, Alexis. I'm all for championing the unfashionable, but I just find this just kind of a bit wafty.
Okay, that's absolutely fine. I stand firm in my judgment. I'm actually really looking forward to his forthcoming album. Oceania.
Yeah, get it
Oceania,
right.
Yeah, I agree. The eco thing, he has been banging on about that. In fairness, there's kind of eco-themed tracks on The Flat Earth and stuff like that.
I was hoping the whole Flat Earth thing was going to be like they actually believed the Earth was flat, but unfortunately, I did a brief bit of internet research, and I was quite sad to find out that he hadn't gone mental and thought that was the case. That would have been a good... exactly, yeah.
Can I just cheerfully point out that the best thing about my research into Thomas Dolby is I've discovered his boat cum studio is called the Nutmeg of Consolation. Which
name.
I think is much better than Americana.
Where do you? I don't think he came up with the name, the Nutmeg of Consolation. I think it might have been you know, just the name of the boat when he took it on. But it is a great thing to be able to say, where do you live? What's your address? My address is the Nutmeg of Consolation. marvellous, marvellous. Okay, final track now from Ben. This is Actress and Harrier Attack. Okay, Actress with Harrier Attack there. Ben, you brought this in. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I brought it in because I wanted to use it to prove a point almost. There was a blog by Simon Reynolds, the music writer, this week, where he was bemoaning the fact that there was nothing new created in dance music anymore and that we were all just recycling early 90s piano house and that dubstep hadn't moved into something new and exciting and there wasn't brand new dance music being made. And I wanted to use that to maybe prove just how exciting I think and fertile the current state of dance music is. I think there are audible kind of references to the past, stuff like Drexia and sort of Detroit techno and things like that. But then there's this kind of sort of denatured and sort of tinny quality to this track that's really sinister and very much a product of a kind of digital internet age, I think. And yeah, I think Actress is one of the most exciting producers around at the moment. Yeah,
tell us a little bit about Actress.
He's I think his name is Darren Cunningham. He runs a label called Work Records. He's also put out releases on Planet Moo and Honest John's. And he's got an enormous variety of sound that he makes. Some of it's almost like 80s boogie influenced.
Right.
Some of it's very, very dry and sparse kind of almost like Altecra at their most baffling. But lots of it is very this kind of groove-led, soulful techno that is just absolutely exemplary. And I think that journalists and people like Reynolds and some music critics are kind of struggling with the idea that there could be a music out there that can't be defined in a simple umbrella term. And I think that that this music that's being made by this kind of current crop of very cosmopolitan producers really resists categorisation.
Who would you include in that group?
Well, I mean, people like, I guess, like Floating Points on the sort of housey end to Ramadan Man, well, Pearson Sound as he is now, Joy Orbison. I mean, all of these people, Peverellis stuff is very techno now. I mean, I don't know if you guys heard the new Burial stuff. It's, he's just kind of, he's almost treading the same path he was before, I think, but still, that's extremely powerful and resonant sound now. So I think there's this huge variety of different music being made that draws on across history, across genre. It can't be pigeonholed, and to pigeonhole it, I think, would kill off this fertile period
that we
have. And I think it is, I think it's a real golden age of dance music, and Reynolds is wrong.
I agree. I think I find that kind of weird post-dubstep world where you can't put a finger on what any of these producers are doing because it changes all the time. You know, if you listen to somewhat from, I really like Floating Points, but if you listen to Floating Points records and remixes, they almost bear very little relation to each other in a weird way, other than the name on the sleeve. And I find that really good. You know, I think that's a really positive and exciting thing. I thought that sounded like an old Aphex Twin.
Yeah.
Contract. That's not no shame in that, I hasten to add. Mm. You know, I felt it sort of really harked back to that, artificial intelligence era of warp stuff. And also that sense that you used to get, the sort of lo-fi thing you used to get with some Aphex Twin tracks. Obviously, they were lo-fi for a different reason than the ones you're stating.
Exactly, there's a sort of analog tape lo-fi decay, quality to them. And then there's this, like this sort of digital decay, I think, on this, which is really affecting.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Kitty?
Yeah, I agree with everything Ben said. But pretty much, but the fact that it's a dubstep, quote-unquote dubstep track without any bass on it is in itself, cool and interesting. You know, that you have all these assumptions about what dubstep is and isn't, and, it's not really the bass-quaking frequencies that we have come to associate with that genre. I like what we quaintly used to call the flip side. There's another track that goes along with it called Gershwin. That's even better. I think Harrier Attack was an early 80s computer game.
It's a ZX Spectrum. I was thinking that as I said it. It's a ZX Spectrum computer game.
There you go. See, you know more than I do. The tinny tsk, 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 of it is probably meant to reference, you know, the early days of gaming and the sort of shrill...
Yeah, sort of Cold War paranoia vibes emanating.
How much more 1983 can you get than a ZX Spectrum game called Harrier Attack?
I'm not as well versed as you gentlemen are in the vast spectrum of it, but I did like the Actress album that came out on Honest John's, and I thought that was kind of an interesting place to put it. I think the label run by Damon Albarn is not where you would naturally hope to find a post-dubstep producer.
Those guys absolutely love like basic channel techno. It's weird, like they, you know, they'll put out so much the dub side of what they do and the kind of very African focused side. It's really interesting to see how I think Honest John's are plotting the way that people are joining the dance between those things. The Moritz von Oswald Trio album that they've just brought out is just my favourite thing yet this year. Absolutely stunning dub techno record, but with a kind of jazz improvisatory sort of 16-minute structures, and then this like weird, like almost like Chris Rea guitar on it. absolutely magnificent record. Yeah.
No, I think Honest John's is a fantastic, exemplary way to run a record label. Mm. And even though quite a lot of what they release is not for me, you know, I find the sort of recordings of 1930s Iraqi street singers and stuff like that, you know, it sort of wears on the old nerves a bit after a while. But I just sort of take my hat off to them for what they're doing. And when they hit it, Honest John's, when they get something good, whether that's some amazing they had a brilliant compilation of old 70s English folk called Never the Same, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Trembling Bells. I think they're really good. I think some of the dance stuff they put out is really good, and some of the sort of archiving of British black music is amazing as well. So thumbs up, I think, for Honest John's, who are now sort of surviving without the support of EMI.
Still think they're mining their gigantic back catalogue that they got, that sort of giant archive.
I've been to that archive, actually.
It's
absolutely amazing place. Because in what used to be EMI's headquarters in Hayes, and the headquarters have totally closed down, so you have to walk through this completely abandoned office building to get incredibly spooky, to get to this immense archive of like everything EMI ever recorded and released. And, you know, it is an amazing sort of weirdly scary atmospheric place. Anywho, there you go. So three thumbs up for Actress's Harrier Attack. So just before we leave, a few tweets and comments from the blog. Last week, there was a mixed response to Ghost Poet being called Watered Down Roots Maneuver. Karuja called him Watered Down Roots Maneuver, and a bit too clever by All About Tactics. Lots of tips on other new UK rap to check out too. SV80 wrote a dissertation on So Solid Crew. Thanks for that, SV80. And there was an insightful comment from Dirt Jam, who wondered if the difference between rap 10 years ago and now was that it all sounded so serious and insular back in the early noughties. Evolution is a wonderful thing. Interesting. There's also a lot of love for Green Gartside from Scritti Politti. Some discussion of gems and duds in the back catalogue. Thanks for all your tweets. Thanks for all your comments. You can follow us on @MusicWeeklyPod, or one word, on Twitter. Or you can leave longer comments on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. That is all for now. My thanks, as ever, to Kitty.
Pleasure.
And to Ben. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back next Friday. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Ian Chambers and Scott Corley. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.